So thank you. Thank you so much for listening to Blue Sky Horse Radio with 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. We're here in Kitchener and Waterloo, and with me on the phone is Minister of Parliament's Matthew Green, and he is out of Hamilton Centre with the New Democratic Party. Thank you so much, Matthew, for speaking with me here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I just want to make sure folks know, while I appreciate the promotion, I'm only a member of Parliament, not a minister yet, but hopefully...
Ah, there we go.
If the new government, if we form government someday, then maybe that will be the case. But for the time being, I'm a very proud member of Parliament representing Hamilton County.
Member of Parliament, thank you so much for speaking with me. And I live here in Kitchener and Waterloo, and I follow you on Twitter, and that's sort of how you came to my attention. Because a lot of people are sort of looking to our political leaders and representatives and wondering who can unite us, who can speak on behalf of everyone and things like that. And I really was interested in hearing about your platform and the vision that you have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're quite right that social media, things like Twitter, provide politicians the opportunity to speak directly to people, unfiltered by media, unfiltered by a lot of the political spin. But I think more importantly, platforms like social media allow the public to speak directly back to their elected officials. There used to be a time when you would have to, you know, maybe write a letter to you and call their office and talk to their administrator, but very few people had the opportunity to talk directly to their representatives. And I think social media has changed that in significant ways, and we've seen the rise of populist politics, particularly from the right perspective, on issues that you know, that are providing what I call like the new civil rights. I think issues around justice and democratic economies, certainly climate change, reconciliation with Indigenous communities are all things that are being discussed. It's a discourse that's happening online in ways that I think are really providing alternatives to what the mainstream narrative, which has been always that Canada is somehow better than everywhere else in the world.
Right. Yeah, we have a lot of, I mean, no country is, I guess, rescued from issues in general. Nowadays, it seems like there's a lot of things happening, especially south of the border. So just things that stood out to me is that you actually talk about anti-racism and anti-fascism. And so, like, can you maybe speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's important for people to understand that you can both love your country and criticize. I think that's okay. And I think that the conversations around racism, around, you know, right-wing politics typically are diverted to the states, to the south, as, you know, as you have just now done. And it really, I think, misses the point often that we're also facing these issues here.
Mm-hmm.
That we are a country that was founded on the displacement and genocide of Indigenous people. The land theft, the colonial land theft of Indigenous people for the purpose of extracting resources, whether it be beaver pelts in early settlements right up into, you know, things like TMX and LNG, and the ongoing struggles even today of Indigenous communities right across the country fighting against ongoing imperial impositions on their communities, whether it's oil and gas or other, you know, justice frameworks that keep Indigenous people constantly left out of having real, true democratic power in the country.
Right. Yeah, it's really horrific to see and follow some of the things that are happening, especially today when, like, the climate crisis should be at the forefront and sort of that's been shuffled to the background again, and fossil fuels are sort of back on the table as acceptable. And there's not a whole lot of conversation about it, even because everybody's talking about COVID at the moment. So,
yeah, but you'll recall, like, right before COVID was the wet soil resistance.
Exactly.
That demonstrated, you know, Indigenous communities, Indigenous-led resistance, or I should say Indigenous leadership on climate justice, starting from as far back as, in my recent memory, of like, I don't know more, to present-day resistance, although it's been ongoing for generations, was a significant milestone. Like, it demonstrated that a few thousand people doing concerted direct action could shut down the government and force them to actually engage in a meaningful way on the issues that Indigenous communities have been fighting for around their own land sovereignty since the arrival of European settlers, right?
Mm-hmm. I know. I seem to recall that there was a blockade of the railway, and shortly after COVID came, so it sort of seemed like the disruption was... I mean, the timing is sort of flawless when you look at it like that, but it's hard to think that the conspiracy is really that deep. Not sure. But thank you for being so diverse and really talking about some of the more difficult things, because, you know, as a resident here in Canada myself, I look and see, I try to find, like, where are the leaders of the future, you know, people that will actually be able to unite the country and deal with the more difficult issues, as opposed to just try to shuffle them under the rug. And so thank you for taking a stand on some of these important issues.
Yeah, and, you know, as a racialized person myself, we don't really have much of a choice. These are experiences that we face every day.
Mm-hmm.
These are barriers that we face every day. So going back to your first question around what it means to be anti-racist, that in Canada for a long time, we've gotten by people feeling like they're not racist.
Yeah.
And feeling like you're not racist is not the same as being actively anti-racist. When you have the privilege of not facing the kind of vitriol, the kind of systemic barriers or the systematic barriers of racism, if you are a non-racialized person, or if you are a white person in Canada, then there's a moral imperative to speak out against what you see to be, in what is obvious, anti-race or racism in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be anti-Indigenous racism, it could be anti-Black racism, it could be Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, all of these things matter. And so taking an active anti-racist perspective requires that people go beyond kind of just feeling good about themselves for not being racist. Like, that's no longer good enough.
Right.
So what I share with people is that if you think about what you would have done during the Holocaust or during the Civil Rights Movement or during slavery or just, you know, all of these things, you're doing it right now. And what I mean by that is that if you are not actively engaging in the conversation around Black Lives Matter and Indigenous Lives Matter, if you're not actively trying to dismantle white supremacy, then you are also being complicit with it, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm a white person. I'm actually an immigrant. I'm from Sweden. I was born in Sweden. I'm a landed immigrant here in Canada. So for me, coming to Canada has been kind of a very eye-opening experience. I didn't grow up in an environment like this, and I had a very quick education on it, coming to Canada and learning about residential schools.
Sure.
And in university, I studied some Indigenous history, and I was ashamed to be white because I knew I looked just like, and I didn't feel like a colonialized person, but I obviously, you know, I'm here on this land also. So, I mean, it's just, I want to try and support Indigenous voices and people of color as much as I possibly can, because that's what I can do.
Yeah. You know, and if you look at my brothers in Norway, and I certainly am not an expert on Scandinavian politics, but I follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll know that there was a long time where countries like Sweden and Norway pride themselves on being these kind of liberal or social democracies.
Right.
That were, you know, founded on progressive ideals to some extent. But even within the last 5 years, we've watched a hard right shift in breaking populism in places like Sweden, where some of the, you know, the founding principles of immigration, not founding principles, but some of the progressive principles that they had taken in the past have been rolled back. And so any country or any community is susceptible to right-wing proto-fascist tendencies.
Right.
You know, and whether it's this idea of scapegoating immigrants or becoming pro-nationalist, you know, those things go hand in hand, and the outcomes are always the same, which is the targeting of marginalized people. They could be queer people, they could be, you know, racialized or Muslim or Indigenous, and it normally comes at the hands of the police, right, and the increased presence of violence around police.
Yes.
Which you got me fired up on a Saturday afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, well, I was reaching out and Tyler got back to me and tried to facilitate his conversation. So it's really great. Yeah, I do my radio show from 12 until 2, and I focus a lot on actually abuse against horses. That's sort of been my focus, and mental health of horses for people with, you know, various PTSD or in general depression and lots of things. Horses can help for community building and mental health.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And then I do this community hour where I do community issues or things that concern us. And music, I support local music. Our station is awesome for supporting local arts and culture. We just did an online concert. So we try to be relevant, and we're an awesome station, of course.
So. Yeah, I love radio. You know what I mean? Like, I love the conversational aspect of it, and the fact that folks are able to tune in. And now, obviously, with the internet, where you can potentially post the audio clips online and stuff.
Yeah. And we're Facebook Live right now from my page as well, Blue Sky Horse Radio. So I just kind of perused some of the pages that have your face on it. And then when people click on Facebook, they can listen to the conversation there as well.
Outstanding. Yeah. You know, I think like that's, it's critically important for a community to kind of maintain their narratives or take back their narratives from mainstream media.
Right.
Because, you know, what the Bay Street media would have us believe in terms of what our interests are, be it working class interests, having solidarity across, you know, all the different intersections of race and gender, sexuality, all these things are critically important, but they're often missing.
Mm-hmm.
So to provide the platforms, really important. I appreciate you for that.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking with me. So, yeah, and I also heard recently, like, the whole concept of defunding the police. Somebody had said something like demilitarizing the police is, like, another way of saying it, and it's a similar thing where people are so afraid of taking away money from the police, but maybe the realization of that, you know, if we put the money into community building and education and social services, then maybe we don't have to have the correctional aspect be so large, and especially if it's a racist institution.
Yeah, you know, so this is the thing for the folks that are listening, because there's a lot of confusion around defund the police and what that means. And I just want to share with people from my perspective, and it's just that, what the reality has been in my community. And I'm sure Waterloo would parallel this. So I'll leave it to people to go and do their own research and not take my word for it. So, for instance, 15 years ago, in 2005, the police budget, the operating annual budget for police in Hamilton, was $100 million. That is a lot of money. That is a significant amount of money. And it represented, you know, 20% of the municipal budget. So for folks that know what Hamilton was like in 2005, you know, they may have an argument. They may have an argument that $100 million goes to police. Now, what people don't understand is that in those last 15 years, this has been a recent shift. It's been a hard shift. That budget has increased from $100 million a year to $171 million a year. So over the last 15 years, it's almost doubled its police budget. While simultaneously, all of our spending on social services is only $158 million. And so we need to recognize that policing doesn't reduce crime. What policing does is pursue crime after it happens. And if you're talking about, you know, property theft or petty crimes, lots of petty crimes happen in communities across the country, we can safely say that the increased investment in policing hasn't really deterred petty crimes. We know that to be true. If you talk about things like vulnerable populations, domestic violence, gender-based violence, sexual assaults, we can safely say, based on the evidence, that this doubling of police budgets hasn't actually made women safer. And as you referenced injustice against Indigenous populations, we know that missing and murdered Indigenous women is a continuing phenomenon that hasn't been addressed by increasing police budgets. We know that to be true. What we also know to be true is that by investing in the social determinants of health, housing, you know, childcare, food programs, diversion programs or recreation programs for kids, significant investments in mental health. If you go to any prison, you will find a disproportionate population of Black and Indigenous people, and you will find a disproportionate population of people living with disabilities, including mental health.
Yeah.
So we're still in a country that doesn't invest in mental health. We don't. And So, you know, from my perspective, and I think, you know, I think what any rational, reasonable person would say is that in Hamilton, if we were to go back to a scenario where the police were still getting $100 million a year, we could adequately provide the law enforcement, quote-unquote, aspects of policing with a significant reinvestment and refunding of critical community supports.
Which is desperately needed because, yeah, and rents are getting higher. And, I mean, here in Kitchener and Waterloo, we've had a lot of recent development. We have the LRT here now, and Google is here. We have a lot of, I mean, it's kind of made it a more hip area to live. And the low-income housing has not matched, you know, other.
No, it never does.
No.
It never does. We've over-commodified real estate, and we've left it to be a place where people can build their wealth from instead of a place where people can be provided with home. So this idea of, like, you know, a homes model, a housing for the purpose of homes versus housing for the purpose of real estate, it is a fundamental question of having a democratic economy. We don't currently have a democratic economy because not everybody has access to capital in the same way that the ultra-wealthy do. So, for instance, for lower-income people to even qualify to get loans is, or to have a system where their jobs pay them well enough to afford a down payment, the vast majority of particularly young people, but also, you know, lower-income folks, working class poor, just can't do it. It's not attainable anymore.
No.
And that needs to change.
Yes, thank you for standing up for that, because it's kind of a sad future to look forward to. And I mean, I grew up in a world where I always thought, you know, things were getting better, and little by little, we've kind of seen freedoms and justice have been stripped away from us. And
that's right.
Where are things going? And I keep saying, where are the leadership? You know, where are the people that can really step up and do it for the sake of honoring their community and themselves, as opposed to lining their own pockets and things like that. So, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, here's the dirty secret, is that we are the leadership we're waiting for. There's no waiting for Superman or Superwoman to come and save us from government. It will not happen, which is why communities have to organize in mutual aid. They have to organize politically and ensure that people, awesome people, are elected. Shout out to Laura May Lindu out there in Kitchener, who's done incredible work for decades on this. And is now in the Ontario legislature. But having these voices present to counter these hard right narratives, because we're going to be facing likely towards austerity, right? Which is more cuts to public services and to programs, more tax breaks for the ultra wealthy. That we need to have voices that are willing to stand up and fight against that. So people like Laura May Lindu are great for Kitchener and we need more, right? Catherine Fife, phenomenal voice coming out of that area. A great work happening there.
That's right. Yeah, you guys are all doing, and ladies are doing great work. And it's, I have reached out to Laura May Lindu too, and I'm looking forward to having her on. I'm still waiting to get connected. So
it's tough. I'll be honest with you. Like, you know, nothing about, so Laura May is in her first term. I'm in my first term. And nothing about any of this is normal, right? It's just a weird scenario. We've all been pushed in where we're trying to continue to fight for our constituents while doing it remotely and also do the legislative work. It's difficult. So I can appreciate why she might be difficult to get a hold of.
Yeah, fair enough. That's understandable. Well, thank you so much, Matthew, for speaking with me here today. I almost want to move to Hamilton. Like, it sounds like a great place to be represented.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Bye, Matthew. So that was Matthew Green, and he is a member of parliament in Hamilton, and we enjoyed our conversation with him here today on Blue Sky Horse Radio with CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. And with that, I'm going to end the Facebook Live.